accession number 21118, Reel 2.
Fred Cooper, Reel 2.
Yeah. The European people there were well aware of the situation, I think, of this spy network, and consequently, they simply said to us, we don't want to know your regiment, we don't want to know any details. If you would like us to inform your family that you were all right when you came through South Africa, simply give us your address and your name. And they said, all we're going to say is Fred was here and he's well. And the family got the message. Cape Town after 4 days, and it really was a good 4 days because after the rationing in England and that, food, fruit, the very things that we were deprived of in this country, were in ample supply in South Africa. Although one of the disturbing features of South Africa, Cape Town, was to see the white and black divide. Really, it was a revelation to me, and something which you think of with regret, you know. See the way the natives were treated compared to the eye knife that the Europeans had. But we left Cape Town and then...
What specific things did you see regarding that?
Well, I can remember once we were in a large store and I can remember there were people running about all over the shop. You thought there was some kind of emergency going on. And all it was, some little lad, about 7 or 8, had got into the shop, a black lad. And he must have had about 30 staff chasing him around the place to get him out. But the things that struck me was, of course, the transport, you know, Europeans only, and the difference in the type of transport where you had normal, comfortable transport for the Europeans and more or less cattle trucks for the natives. But after we left Cape Town, we had a bit of an interesting journey. Mind you, while we were on board, getting to South Africa, one or two scares, we had quite a large escort. And at night time, we had some alarms. And you put your light belt on, went on deck, and you could see our escorting vessels with a large headlight charging to a certain spot where presumably they believed there was a U-boat or something. And we had this several times during the journey. But when we left Cape Town, we were on the more hazardous part of the journey, around the east coast of Africa, up the Straits of Madagascar, and into the Red Sea, which was considered to be perilous, you know, as far as U-boats were concerned. And we were told that the ships and the convoy was going to zigzag its way up there, and no question of keeping a straight line. It was zigzagging through the Red Sea. But then we got through that, and we landed at Port Shufik. And from Port Shufik, we waited for a train which took us to a camp at Geneva. And when we got to Geneva, really began to notice the difference in the climate and how it affected you, you know. Didn't feel like eating much solid food, but... capacity for drinking was about fourfold what it is in this country. a pint mug of tea, where one would be quite sufficient, I went up and got three or four mugs to replace the loss, you know. But when we were there, we did what they call an acclimatization period, where we did various exercises and drills in the morning and some in the evening. Obviously, during the midday in the afternoon period, it was too hot, and nothing was done during that period. But then after I'd been there a few days, I got shifted up to Cairo, from Cairo to Alexander, and from Alexander into Alamein, to join the 2nd Battalion, the King's Royal Rifle Corps.
Which year was this?
1942.
Do you know the month?
Month?
Do you know the month?
Yes, it was just before the Battle of Alamein.
What did the front line look like at Alamein at that time?
Well, it was fairly quiet. There was a lot of activity going on, tactical exercises and people getting fit and, you know, physical exercises, tactical exercises and training generally. Montgomery was still fairly new out there, and in our particular regiment, we felt sorry that when Ritchie was replaced as the 8th Army commander by Churchill, they selected Lieutenant General Gott, who was a member of our regiment, to take command of the 8th Army. But unfortunately, when he got called to Cairo to be told of his new appointment, on the way back his plane was shot down, and consequently Montgomery was appointed. But the front at that time, Montgomery was a fairly new boy, and the front at that time was full of activity. Obviously it was a front line, but behind the scenes there was a lot of activity, training and physical training, and a lot of activity going on.
Which company and platoon were you in at that time?
I was in C Company, number 12 platoon. Well, no. I was in C Company, but I was put in the mortar section because I was a trained 3-inch mortar man. I'd been on the course in this country, at a place just outside, about 11 miles from Northampton. Whilst we were at Northampton, I did just 2 months' course where I was transferred to the Reconnaissance Corps. And I undertook this 3-inch mortar training, which was a fairly new weapon with our regiment. And Kettering was where we had the training course, and consequently as a trained mortarman they were short of these, and were happy to have me and anybody else that was a trained mortarman. So I went into the mortar section, and I was in the mortar section during the Battle of Alamein, and was afterwards I was transferred to given a Lance Jack stripe, and transferred to one of the sections after the Battle of Alamein.
Can you tell me what you thought about the 3-inch mortar, please?
3-inch mortar, I thought was a very, very good weapon. You know, it's in an infantry regiment or battalion such as ours, it was in fact the heavy artillery of the regiment. They had nothing bigger. A 3-inch mortar, they had 2-inch mortars, 3-inch mortars. I thought it was a very good weapon. it wasn't used too much at Alamein because of the amount of guns that we had there. On one or two occasions it was used, but there really wasn't much need for it until you got out in the desert because of the concentration of artillery that there was at Alamein.
What do you remember about living conditions in the Alamein line in 1942?
Well, we were on the move almost continuously. Kidney Ridge, I think Alamein, it's very, very difficult to recall exactly what happened at Alamein because you were so tired, so worn out. The amount of shellfire, I think people who were at Alamein were on a different wavelength to the rest of humanity. You know, they were men similar to being drugged or drunk, you know, after the pressures of the battle and loss of sleep and that sort of thing.
Why couldn't you get any sleep?
Well, you know, with the gunfire and the fact that with the army in battle, 3 o'clock in the morning is the same as 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. You're on call 24 hours a day. And I can remember we went back for a rest, and when we went back for this rest, we had 24 hours rest. We had our company commander, who was an Eton master. He'd been wounded, and he was very lucky to escape. He had a shrapnel wound which almost cut his windpipe, and he had his neck strapped up, and we were out for 24 hours, and when we went back, within 2 hours he was dead, killed. But when we got pulled out the line at Alamein for a rest, and that was an experience because apart from having a rest, you had the chaplains come round to give services before you go back in again the following day, you know, bearing in mind the number of casualties you've already had. And, you know, I'm not a Christian, but it puts a morbid touch on things, you know. When I was a Roman Catholic, went to a Roman Catholic school, and I think the padre himself was a bit demoralised at the time, and consequently, when he spoke to us, he had that attitude. We might all be dead tomorrow. You know, didn't exactly lift your spirits morally. But I can remember going back after this 24-hour rest, and as it was 6 o'clock in the morning, we went back, and I can remember the sun was shining in the east. As we're going through the guns, you know, we'd been gone back about 12 mile for this 24-hour rest. And we were coming through the guns, and the guns were firing, that tremendous concentration of guns had at Alamein. And when he looked back, the sun was shining, the air was clear in the east. And looking to the west, it looked like a wall of sand, you know, where the artillery was churning it up, the tanks were churning it up, and I don't forget this occasion because when we got near, about 300 prisoners came out, German prisoners who'd been under our barrage, and they were unshaven. You could see some of them shaking, and you thought to yourself, I thought the same as the others. Well, that's another 300 we haven't got to deal with. But then, after a while, you come to the conclusion, well, they are perhaps better off than we are. They've been eliminated from the carnage and we're going back into it. But, on that particular morning, I can remember we had a rather tough day, and this mortar section that I was in had 4 casualties in 15 minutes. What we actually did, we were with the tanks, and we tried to make a wedge, and we drove in, and as we drove in, we got, I think, somewhere about 400 yards in. But then, because it was a wedge, the Germans were firing HE and anti-tank stuff from the right flank, from the left flank and forward. And our objective was a ridge. Well, when we first went in, we got such a concentration of fire, we pulled back. And then we reorganised and went back in again with a determination to stop there. You know, the officers were determined that we should stop there. And it was then that we suffered these four casualties within about 15 minutes. Almost became the section, motor section, almost become non-operational. But we happened to win the day, but I'd never forget it because, and people may disbelieve this, I don't talk about these things to people because they think you're trying to be some kind of Rambo, believing that you're trying to say you won the war on your own. But on this particular night, the ridge that we were intent on capturing, we did capture. It was a ridge, I suppose, not much higher than this room. But on top of the ridge was about six Sherman tanks. One of them was white hot, and the others were all in shades of red, various shades of red, when they'd been set on fire. And I think it's, unless you've seen it, it's difficult to convince people that you've seen a tank white hot, absolutely white hot, glowing like an electric light bulb. And the others, you know, in various shades of red when they've been burnt out. Whether it's the amount of phosphorus these tanks carry, you know, which gives off tremendous heat, I don't know. But I remember at the end of that day, we were all relieved that the Germans had pulled back and that we weren't getting the flak left, right and centre. But sad to see these tanks, you know, we'd lost six tanks and you see them on this ridge in various shades, from white hot to dark red.
Which tank regiment were you operating with?
At that time, we were in the... To be frank, I don't know the regiments in that, because we were then in the 1st Armour Brigade, 1st Armour Division, which was the Charging Rhino. And when the breakthrough at Alamein came, we were something like fifth line of defence, you know, everybody passed through us. And shortly after that, we got transferred back into the 7th Armoured Division.
Do you remember how these four casualties occurred?
Shrapnel.
Did you see them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I was with them. They were part of our section. I can remember one chap there when we first went in. We were in a truck, in the back of a truck, and he put down these what they call airburst shells, which they normally use for ranging. But in fact, they're frightening, you know, if you see six or seven of those explode in the air. But a chap I was with on the truck, when we pulled back and got out, he said to me, look at this, and the rim of his tin helmet was curled up like a watch spring. Well, lump of shrapnel, people don't realise the power of shrapnel, I don't think. I could, you know, going off the subject for a while, to say that I can remember in Normandy, I had my kit bag on the floor, and this is just a typical example of the power of shrapnel. And one of our own guns was ranging. Yeah, I was digressing on this point, which probably we come back to later on, but it was during the course of Normandy, and it was one of our shells that landed next to me kit bag. And in that kit bag, I had a new pair of ammunition boots. And, of course, when the shell landed, we ducked out and took cover in case there was any more following, but it happened to be a ranging shell. But when I saw my kit bag, it had two large holes in it. I undid it, took one of the boots out, and this was a new pair of army ammunition boots, which are fairly solid in leather, about 3 layers of leather in a pair of ammunition boots, and a mass of rivets at the bottom. But the shrapnel had cut through the sole of it like a knife through butter. Which was a revelation to me, you know, the power of shrapnel should do that.
Any more details you can remember about the Battle of Alamein?
Look, I remember a humorous one. At the back end, we'd done several attacks, and at the back end, we were on the Raymond track where the breakthrough took place.
The what track?
The Raymond track. I think it's spelled R-A-H-M-A-N, the Raymond track, which is in fact where the breakthrough took place. And I remember that we was in a mortar section, but we stopped the truck, and we were near the Raymond track itself, and we all got down, we crept up, and you could hear foreign voices. You couldn't tell whether they were English, Italian or German, but the officer in charge crept closer and said they're Italian. And what had happened on this Raymond track, which is a track that goes from north to south, and it was a collecting link, a communications link with the Italian troops in the south, and these people didn't realise that we were close. And there was a couple of people, groups of them, talking to one another with a convoy of vehicles. So this officer gave the command, fix swords. And it was the only bayonet charge I'd ever done. And he said charge, so he charged. And I was confronted with about three Italians around a truck. And in a bayonet charge, of course, you go for it. And there was a big Italian, and I took a lunge at him with a bayonet. And he turned, and I drove the bayonet into the truck. And you know the sort of iron framework they put round a truck? It's it that. And the next thing I heard was a little plop on the ground, and when I looked, I had about that an inch and a half of bayonet left. The rest was on the ground. And the Italian just stood there with his hands up with a smile on his face. But on that Raymond track, one of the things about that was, I think one of the more frightening things was that we were told we were going to do this job at 3 o'clock in the morning. Attack the Raymond track. And this was about 9 o'clock at night, and it was a light night, and preparations were made for the attack, and already we were quite demoralised, you know, with what we'd been through. And as we laid on the side of the road, so a fleet of ambulances came up to deal with our casualties, you know, which is not... exactly, a morale booster. I'll never forget that because it has, under them circumstances, it adds a rather gloomy prospects for the future. But the breakthrough at Alamein, then there was a lot of activity going on. We got pulled back, and we went to sleep by the side of the tanks. And the next morning when we woke up, there was all the stuff that Montgomery had in reserve for the breakout was all passing through us. Yeah. And everywhere you looked, as far as you could see in front, as far as you could see to the left and the right, was a mess of vehicles churning up the smoke. And despite the fact that you'd had a large number of casualties, where our battalion had been reduced more or less to one company in strength because of the number of casualties, despite that, a sort of, if I can put it this way, holiday feeling began to creep over you, that things were going right, that it had perhaps been worthwhile after all.
You described that incident where you drove the wedge into the enemy positions with the tanks.
Yeah.
Was that the only occasion you did that?
No, there was one occasion when the battalion on Kidney Ridge, several regiments had tried to capture this position and then and had failed to do so. And on, I think, about the third night, whoever was in command, the brigadier or whoever made the decision, decided that our regiment, in its trucks, in its vehicles, should charge the position in its vehicles rather than infantry on foot. And nearly every vehicle was set on fire. You know, the amount, when I say nearly every vehicle was set on fire, let's say a large percentage, at least 50% of the vehicles were burnt.
What opinion did you form of the German and Italian enemies?
Well, I think the German army, obviously, they had crack troops out there, 21st, 10th Panzer Division. They had an Hermann Göring Division out there, on the, and the crack 90th Light Division. The Italians had the, I think the most famous of it was the Ariati Division. The difference was that the German army was very much like the British army in terms of tactics. Nighttime patrols, counter patrols, activity, Harrison tactics as they called it, never let the enemy rest. Italians, if you're opposite the Italians, you can go to sleep, know perfectly well there's never going to be a patrol out. That was the attitude that we had. When the Italians were our enemies, we looked on them, you know, ready to put a white flag up as soon as you looked at them. No fight at all in them. When they eventually became our allies, perhaps the media were more kinder to them and said that because of Abyssinia, Spain, and the desert, their troops had perhaps had too much and had lost their appetite for battle, which I think was perhaps a kinder way of putting it than they.
Was there any air activity during the Alamein battle that you
saw? Oh, yes, there was what they called a shuttle service of Bostons, who were bombing the Germans just forward of the front line. And there was also what they used to call shifty kites, that's a reconnaissance aircraft, keeping the enemy under constant observation and obviously acting as reconnaissance for these Boston shuttles that used to go over. A great deal of aircraft.
So you said you saw Monty's reserves go through. What do you remember next?
Well, we tagged on the back. You know, they designated something. Somebody said we were fifth line of defence at that time, you know. You've always got an operational role, it seemed, in the army, and you had people go through. You were the forward troops one day. Once a breakthrough took place, then you take your place in the order of things. And as we understood it at that time, we were fifth line of defence. That's like the enemy counterattack, so, you know, in the fifth line defence. But we taked on, and we didn't do a lot. I can remember one incident, which